Coming up on the program today, what the price of iron ore in China has to do with, well, with everything, pretty much. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, the seventh day of March. Great, as always, to have you here, everybody. You know how sometimes you read or you hear a news story, and you get to the end, and you realize it wasn't really about what the headline said it was about? I know, right? Makes you crazy. Anyway, here is our offering in that genre today. Iron ore prices spiked 17% this Monday after a weekend meeting in Beijing at which the Chinese government announced it expects its economy to grow by at least 6.5% this year. That means more demand for steel in the world's second largest economy and thus in the demand for the iron ore that's a key ingredient in making that steel. Marketplace's Nova Sappho is going to report this one out for us, but here's a hint. It ain't really about the iron ore.
So iron ore prices have spiked, and China is setting ambitious targets for its economic future. Optimistic? Let Dan Rohr burst your bubble. He's a director of materials equity research at Morningstar, and his assessment of the iron ore rally.
So is it sustainable? Probably not.
Rohr says China has built so much already that there simply can't be a huge spike in demand for raw materials.
We expect Chinese steel demand to decline as China builds a lot of skyscrapers, highways, and manufacturing plants, but fewer than it did in the years past.
The Chinese government said over the weekend that there will be more road building, more railways. But economist Barry Bosworth of the Brookings Institution, who studies the Chinese economy, is not persuaded that such plans can get China to 6.5% growth.
They are trying to do a very difficult transition.
Bosworth says the world isn't buying as many of China's exports, and the country has to adapt.
They're trying to move out of this emphasis on government-led investment to consumption. And that's a very difficult transition to make.
For one, the savings-happy Chinese have to be persuaded to spend more. Even if China were to do everything right, there's also the question of whether we can even trust China's numbers. Nicholas Lardy of the Peterson Institute for International Economics says, well, kinda.
I don't think their numbers are exact to the, to the last decimal place.
But Lardy says that's less because they're cooking the books and more because their economy is rapidly changing.
You can't just look at the headline number. You've got to kind of dig beneath the surface and see what else is going on.
And what Lardy sees beneath the surface is a still growing China. But at 6.5%? Not likely. In Chicago, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
This is going to come as news to exactly none of you, but there is a ton of money to be made in healthcare if you can figure out how to lower healthcare spending. One of the ways to do that, says conventional wisdom, is with what are called minute clinics, the 2,000-odd retail healthcare offices you find in big box stores and in pharmacies. I know you've seen them. The thinking is that people are going to choose those over the more expensive doctor's office visits or trips to emergency rooms. That is happening a bit, but just not enough to offset the costs of all the new people coming into the clinics who until now had just stayed home. From the help desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein is on that one.
A minute clinic is to healthcare what an iPhone is to email.
Because it's so convenient for me to check my email on my iPhone, I check it a lot, way more than I may need to.
That's Dr. Ativ Mehrotra, a policy analyst at RAND and one of the study's authors. He says thanks to the rise of all these clinics, folks with a cold, the flu, or a sore throat are getting care instead of staying home. That may improve their health, but does little to save money long term.
If this was a study showing that more people are getting mammograms and colon cancer screening, I'd be excited and happy, and this would be great. But the rub here is the types of care that's being provided. You know, is this high-value care that we're providing?
It's difficult to say from this report, given some of the data is a few years old and looks just at commercially insured patients. Dr. Andrew Sussman, head of Minute Clinic for CVS Health, says the same convenience that makes it easy for someone to deal with a cold also helps a newly insured patient get care for their diabetes.
We see a lot of people who their Minute Clinic visit is their first entry into the healthcare system. We refer them to physicians for follow-up so that they can get to the healthcare that they need.
It would be nice to draw a definitive conclusion on minute clinics, but that's not happening today. But what is a little clearer, says Harvard economist Catherine Baker, is insurers who look to these clinics to save money may have to rethink that strategy.
People had hoped that by making retail clinics available, that we'd see a big reduction in emergency department use, and we just haven't seen that.
Baker says rather than worrying about MinuteClinic visits, insurers could get a lot more bang for the buck if they figured out why people are still showing up in the ER, even when they don't have to. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
What's that, Wall Street Today in five words or less, Kai? All right, here you go. Mixed could have been worse. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The latest in a very long line of what have been billed as very important meetings on the European migrant crisis started this morning in Brussels. Leaders of the European Union and its member states had a sit-down with the Turkish prime minister about the millions of refugees, 2.7 million refugees, according to the United Nations, who have fled the civil war in Syria and are in Turkey right now. Millions more, at least, have passed through Turkey on the way to Europe, and therein lies the issue. The BBC's Damian Grammaticus is in Brussels at the leaders' meeting. Damian, it's good to speak with you.
Good evening.
What, first of all, has been decided today at this meeting?
Well, as we're talking to you now, nothing particularly has been nailed down. The European leaders have already met with the Turkish Prime Minister. He put forward new plans and new demands, you might call them, of Europe if Turkey is going to cooperate to slow down and stop the flow of people, that all of those refugees and migrants getting onto boats and crossing the sea to Greece. Now, what he's been asking for is more money. So 3 billion euros, that's roughly $3 billion, just a bit more than that, over the next 3 years to help fund schools and medical facilities for Syrians currently in Turkey. But more than that, he's making political demands too. So he wants by the end of June for Turks to be given visa-free access to the European Union, and he wants the European Union to speed up discussions that have been going on for 10 years now about Turkey possibly joining the EU. Those are his demands. European leaders have been discussing what they are prepared to accept, and the two sides still have to sit back down around a table and hammer out a final agreement.
And the European leaders also want Turkey to not only stop the refugees from coming, but to take back some who have already transited through Turkey and gotten into Europe, yeah?
Well, what they're talking about in the documents that have been circulating during these discussions is a plan, it seems, where the refugees, migrants getting on the boats, crossing over from Turkey, landing on Greece, could be returned immediately back to Turkey. And then on a sort of one-for-one basis, so one person returned back to Turkey, the EU would then take a person deemed a genuine refugee already in Turkey and airlift them to Europe and resettle them somewhere in Europe.
This crisis has been going on for 18 months at least anyway. One does wonder where European leaders have been trying to figure out a solution.
Well, I can tell you they've been here having summits like this every month, sometimes every couple of weeks. We have another one, in fact, at the end of next week, also on this topic. They're going to be back here again in what, a little more than 10 days' time. So they've been in and out of this building, and we've been in and out of this building, sitting here late into the night every time as they sit around the table. They've made agreements, and the problem is that they haven't seen them through. They've even made agreements with Turkey before, and those have delivered very little. Now we see Turkey increasing its demands, European leaders under even more pressure to try to sort of get a grip on the situation, and Greece in the middle of it, very frustrated. The Greek Prime Minister coming in today was saying that he was frustrated because the past agreements to help his country cope with this have not been followed through by other Europeans.
Damian Grammaticus, the BBC's European correspondent. We got him in Brussels at the European leaders' meeting, as you can hear in the background there. Damian, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Nestled deep in the middle of the alphabet soup of government agencies that inhabit Washington, D.C., is one that can and often does have quite an impact on consumers' lives in this country, but one which is also changing as the economy changes. The FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, is spending more and more of its time on high tech. Edith Ramirez has been the chairwoman of the FTC since 2013. Ms. Ramirez, it's good to have you here.
Delighted to be here.
This is going to sound like a really silly question, but what do you do every day?
We're an independent federal agency that has a mandate to protect consumers and promote competition. What that means on the consumer protection side is mainly to tackle deceptive and unfair practices. Mm-hmm. When it comes to competition, we analyze mergers to assess whether proposed mergers will be pro-competitive or anti-competitive. And then we also look at business conduct to see and protect against any anti-competitive acts that businesses may undertake.
So could you conceivably be sitting on your couch one night watching TV and see some ad and say, that can't possibly be true? And you walk in
Absolutely.
The next day, right?
Absolutely. One of our core areas is, in fact, monitoring the advertising to ensure that it's accurate. Today, just to give you an example of the mix of both technology and advertising, we see a lot of new apps, for instance, that mm-hmm. are making lots of claims. So we recently had a case involving an app that claimed that it could improve your vision if you did some exercises while using the app. In fact, we looked at the supposed scientific backup for that claim, and we didn't feel that it was adequately backed up. So we brought an action against that. So we want to stop those kinds of claims that are deceptive. We want to make sure that consumers can trust the marketplace, can trust the information that's
right
out there.
When you say bring an action, what does that entail? Do you get companies to promise to never do it again and then you keep an eye on them? Do they pay a monetary fine? How does your discipline, I guess, work?
First and foremost, we're a civil law enforcement agency, which means that we have the ability to bring a lawsuit against companies that have violated the law. In fact, we end up resolving via settlement most of our actions, which I think is an efficient way of addressing a lot of the problems that we see. We often try, number one, to make sure that the unlawful act ends. But then we also, as appropriate, want to be able to get money back in the hands of consumers. Sometimes we can't reach a resolution with the company, and in those instances, we'll certainly go forward and file a lawsuit in court.
I was doing some reading before we chatted, and I saw a piece that suggested the Federal Trade Commission might be more accurately described in the 21st century as the Federal Technology Commission, just because you guys spend so much time on that. What do you think?
I think that's an apt description. Given the role that technology plays in our lives today, we need to be aware of what's happening in the marketplace when it comes to technology. Not only do the vast majority of us have smartphones, in addition, we're also bringing what are known as Internet of Things devices mm-hmm. into our homes. We're using wearables. All of these devices are providing all sorts of services and benefits for consumers, but we're also raising a number of risks. That includes privacy and data security risks. So we're keeping an eye on those.
I wonder then, given all that's been in the news about Apple and encryption and all of that, I wonder if you feel sometimes that technology is outstripping society's ability to keep tabs on it.
I think it's certainly a challenge, and one of the things that we want to do and that we need to do in order to be an effective police agency, basically, is to stay on top of those technological changes. So we have a group of experts at our agency dedicated to monitoring how technology is being used by consumers. So that's absolutely a challenge, but part of what we do is to precisely to keep our finger on the pulse of changes mm-hmm. in the marketplace.
So in 10 years... maybe even five, actually, given how fast technology is going. What does the Federal Trade Commission look like?
I think it's going to look similar to who we are today, but I think you're going to see even a larger number of technologists in the agency. Right now, we're comprised of economists and attorneys mainly.
Sounds like a fun office, by the way.
But we increasingly have been recruiting tech-savvy personnel to both help us with the enforcement work that we do, but then also to undertake research. We want to be studying the marketplace. We want to be studying particular technological developments so that we can have a handle on them and make recommendations to Congress and other policymakers as well, in addition to the law enforcement work that we do.
Edith Ramirez is the chairwoman of the Federal Trade Commission. Ms. Ramirez, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up.
He didn't want to wait and build his own distillery, so he purchased whiskeys from distilleries.
Anticipation is a tricky business model, you know. Our series, I've Always Wondered, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Ups, downs, and all arounds, that's where we are today. The Dow Industrials up 0.4%, 67 points, 17,073. The NASDAQ down 0.2%, 8 points, 4708. The S&P 500 added just under 0.1%, about a single point, 2001. Energy drove the happy music today, although I know it's not happy. Murphy, how about the happy side, right? Murphy Oil bubbled up more than 12%. Southwestern Energy advanced 9%. Crude oil, by the way, up 5.5% today. All right, losing side. Technology, Facebook dropped nearly 2.5%. Alphabet and Amazon each unloaded more than 2% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.90%. And you, yes you, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Interesting observation from the Marketplace editorial meeting this morning. We were talking about Zootopia, the new Disney animated feature, and it turns out the two people who don't have little kids did go see it this weekend. The two of us with little kids didn't. So with that as your guide, this number nearly $74 million at the box office, making it the best ever opening for a non-Pixar Disney cartoon. Could wind up that Zootopia even beats Frozen in total domestic box office, which would be saying something, and which would also be just the beginning of the potential revenue stream for this thing. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has the story.
Zootopia has all the qualities of a Disney juggernaut. Likeable characters, an entertaining story, and a sing-along worthy anthem.
I won't give up, no, I won't give in.
Till I reach the end, then I'll start again. Sorry, back to the story. And Disney has a long track record of turning box office gold into more gold. Martin Lewison is a professor at Farmingdale State College.
They're really good at leveraging those stories and the characters that they've created and turning them into essentially marketable super systems.
Those marketable super systems include toys, DVDs, theme park rides, music, video games, sequels, serials, bedsheets, plush, you name it. And turning big movies into brands is something Disney's been doing since the earliest days. Marty Sklar was the creative head of Disney Imagineering for 3 decades.
Walt started it right from the beginning because everything in Disneyland really was based on something else that he had done.
Yes, he says marketing potential is important, but a good idea comes first.
And once they get the story right, then they can start looking at all the different ways that you can attach the story.
But could a rabbit and a fox and some very slow talking sloths earn billions the way Frozen's Anna and Elsa have? I called up USC marketing professor Ira Kolb.
Well, you know, it's hard for me to say because my crystal ball broke last week.
But he says, based on the power of Disney's marketing department, Zootopia very well could be the next big thing. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Every now and then on the program, we turn it over to you. Your questions, our answers about this or that bewildering topic in business or the economy for a segment that we call I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get 1 answer, by brain work and blade work.
Today, booze, whiskey to be specific, and the magic of distillation by which fields of grain like barley or corn or rye can become something quite different. The thing is, that magic takes a while, years actually, which brought this question from listener Steve Burton.
Well, I'm a big Johnny Walker fan, which is a Scotch whiskey. And I've always wondered, you know, the first person that created it, how did they even think to make a profit in their lifetime? I mean, was it for the kids' kids or something? I mean, it just doesn't make too much sense to me. Or are they lying to us? I mean, how do you invest in something that you don't plan on selling for like 20 years, 25 years?
Marketplace's Sally Herships has this one.
First of all, you should know that when Johnny Walker founded his company in 1820, he didn't have to worry about turning a profit quickly.
I mean, John Walker was Scottish, so he was in the business of making money. And
Ewan Morgan is with Diageo, the company that now makes Johnny Walker.
And, you know, to that point, he didn't want to wait and build his own distillery. So he purchased whiskeys from distilleries. So he had an immediate revenue stream.
And there's more. Back then, aged whiskey wasn't as common as it is now. People used to drink it young or even right out of the still. But that all changed in the middle of the 19th century when a great wine blight struck Europe. Morgan says a tiny aphid called phylloxera destroyed vines across the continent. Bad news for vineyard owners, but great news for distillers like Johnny Walker.
So cognac was out and brandy was out and wine was out. So the aristocracy and the higher classes had to find an alternative.
And that alternative was whiskey. But in order to get their beverage to market, distillers had to put it in barrels. And
that the longer the journey took, the better the spirit tasted.
Storing whiskey in wooden barrels can enhance its flavor, kind of like salt. So whiskey, especially aged whiskey, became very common. And while Johnny Walker didn't have to worry about delayed profits, today's distillers do. Aged whiskey can get a high price. And in the meantime, distillers have to find another way to bring in cash.
When people call me, the first thing I say out the door is, if you get your distillery open in 2 years, I'll fly out and take you out to dinner.
Bill Owens is founder of the American Distilling Institute. It's an industry organization for distillers. And he does not make turning a quick profit on whiskey sound easy. He says opening a distillery can cost up to $1 million.
And all of a sudden you're out $6,000 a month negative cash flow for 2 years. You better be prepared for what I call the punishment, because you're going to spend a lot of money to get those doors open.
What's the punishment?
Losing money.
Owen says just ordering a still, what you use to make whiskey, can take a year. Then there's finding a space, getting permits from the city, and, of course, waiting for your whiskey to age.
Because if it takes a couple of years to get up and running, how do you, you know, how do you get the
cash? It's easy. Okay. It's easy. You keep your day job.
Or you make gin or vodka, spirits that don't need to age. But that's not what Colin Spolman did. He grew up in Kentucky. Later, as an adult, he started experimenting, making what you might call a young whiskey. He made it in his apartment in New York. There was just one problem.
You know, it's illegal to sell it. Obviously, it's even illegal to make it.
So you were not making moonshine in your apartment?
Well, it was moonshine. So,
but rest assured, Spolman got some private backing and made his business official. In 2011, he co-founded the Kings County Distillery in New York, which is where we are now.
This is the tasting room. So this is where we, in our booze-ium. So this is where we have...
Wait, did you say booze-ium?
Booze-ium, yeah.
Past the booze-ium is a giant room full of wooden barrels stacked on shelves. Spolman says the distillery has almost 2,000. Some whiskey will age here for years. But he says the business has to strike a balance between romantic whiskey dreams for the future and sales today.
We as a business are a little bit torn between the practicality of this, which allows us to be in business, and the fun of this, which is this kind of hope for the future.
And as for Stephen Burton, our listener who worried about how distilleries find the cash to get started in the first place.
You know, it just seems hard. If I've started a business and I wasn't going to make a profit for 20 years.
Wait, did you say you had started a business, or you said like
theoretically? Well, actually, I am starting a business. I'm leaving my job in about 2 weeks. If he hears this, my boss will be finding out for the first time. But
oh, no.
I'm giving my 2 weeks next week.
It sounds like it's time for a drink. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
We need your help to make this series work. Hit us up at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which tennis superstar Maria Sharapova learns the hard way you gotta read your emails. Sharapova announced this afternoon she has tested positive for a banned substance at the Australian Open, something called Mildrinate, which is a heart medication, which it turns out Sharapova had been taking since 2006, but which the World Anti-Doping Agency put on its banned list January 1st of this year. Sharapova said she got the email, which had a link to the new list of banned substances, but she didn't click on it. Two things. Aren't the IT experts always saying not to click on links in emails? Also, she owned it, took full responsibility for the mistake, said she hopes to come back. A little bit of good, a little bit of bad. The Dow up 0.4%, the NASDAQ down 0.2%, the S&P 500 just under 0.1% on the upside. We'll call it even. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.